So, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
This is week two of this Dharma seminar that I'm calling Practicing with Anger in Angry Times. How many of you were here last week? Just so I... Yeah, more than half, but not everybody. And welcome to those who are coming for the first time. Don't worry about missing last week. It's on the website if you want to listen to the podcast. Last week we talked about what anger is. Very simply, it's a threat to us, right? The self. And what the self identifies with. Me and mine. Anger is one of the three poisons. Greed, hatred, and ignorance in Buddhist thought. And we talked about the powerful energy of anger. How it can fuel long-held resentments and grudges. It can spark wars, and it can destroy personal relationships. The other thing we mentioned is that anger isn't just the primitive reaction to strike back. It's also the whole sort of complex of thoughts and emotions that goes with it. So that primitive strike back response alone will dissipate very quickly if the threat vanishes. But it's all our stories that keep, you know, by which we hang on to our anger and grudges. So today we'll focus more on how to practice with anger. Without acting it out in ways that are harmful to others and to ourselves. I didn't mention last week the classic analogy the Buddha used is like it's like anger, striking out in anger is like picking up a coal to throw it at someone else, and it's your own hand that gets burned. So without harming others, but also without holding it in and letting it smolder inside, because that's harmful too. So how do we do that? We stop, we sit down, we pay attention, beginning with our breath and our body. So I would like you to take a few minutes to do a short experiment with me, if you're willing, and feel, just to see how anger feels in the body. This is a practice suggested by Pema Chodron, the American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, in a book called No Time to Lose. Feel free to opt out. You know, if anger is feeling a little bit too intense for you right now, or you're feeling kind of vulnerable, feel free to just kind of ground yourself and look at the altar, maybe, if you don't want to do this little exercise. But I'll keep it quite simple. So what I'd like you to do is take your zazen posture and take a moment just to become aware of your breath. Feel the air coming in through the nostrils, filling the lungs, and then emptying out again. Breathing in and breathing out. Now, bring to mind a recent experience of frustration, annoyance, resentment, or anger. Probably on the lower end of the scale for this purpose, rather than full-on rage, but some fairly small experience of anger. Just remember it. And notice what thoughts and feelings accompany that memory. You may notice how the thoughts or the narrative that accompany this memory can easily get kind of obsessive or repetitive in quality. And how they can fuel a kind of judgmental state. But just allow that memory to arise. And notice what happens in your body. Notice how you feel in your body. Notice any changes in your breathing. Any feeling of contraction. Color is anger. What temperature? Does anger have a smell or a taste? See if you can drop beneath that sort of hard, defended surface of the anger and feel a kind of tender, vulnerable place beneath it. Often there's fear there. See if you can feel that sort of vulnerable underbelly of anger. And continuing to breathe, hold that state of vulnerability with the patience and compassion you might offer to an upset child. Breathing, calming. Knowing that you may not be finished with this anger, but for now, you can let it rest. And come back to the present. So to help to come back to the present, open your eyes. And then do a little movement. Shake your arms out a little, just to kind of dispel the energy. that may have come up with your anger. And don't feel bad. Don't feel like you did it wrong if you couldn't, you know, really connect to something. Just in that short little exercise, it's something that you might try next time you're sitting in meditation and anger comes up, a memory comes up. You can do that exercise and partly just giving that to you so you can try it on your own, because it's, you know, it's hard to do it. Just you may or may not have been able to do that right now. But when you're sitting and anger arises, you can attend to it in that way and feel down under the surface of that defended place. What does anger feel like in the body, typically? Any words come to mind?
Heat.
Often heat.
Tension.
Yeah. Do your face flush? Yeah. Sometimes even shaking. It's not very pleasant, usually, is it? And yet, for some people, it has an addictive quality. Because it makes us, in that moment, feel more powerful. And that feels better than the alternatives of feeling fear, right? Or pain, or shame, or guilt. When we feel angry, we feel right, and the other person is wrong. And that feels better than feeling wrong ourselves, doesn't it? So, can we simply fully experience and inhabit that state when it arises, without even identifying it as my anger, you know? But anger arising, feeling it how it feels in the body. Heat in the throat often, constriction in the chest. And then investigating how it affects the mind. Do the thoughts become narrow, repetitive, anxious? And notice the judging voices that usually accompany anger. Sometimes judging others, or sometimes we turn it on ourselves, depending which habit pattern is more common for us. You may or may not be aware of the triggering moment of an arising of anger, but you might be able to identify it in retrospect more easily. Oh, yeah, that really pushed my button. Right. You may also be aware of any impulses that arise, the impulse to retaliate or to withdraw. Right? In our meditation, we can stay present with those states, patiently, neither trying to drive them away nor feeding them. You know the expression nursing a grievance, right? That we feed it. We keep it going by obsessing. If you can stay present with the changing texture of anger, you may begin to see just how insubstantial it is, that this is a conditioned arising, and it passes if you don't feed it. You may even begin to feel some compassion for yourself in this suffering that anger is, and even begin to get glimpses of insight that your suffering is not so very different from that of others, even those who seem to be causing harm to you, you know, who seem to be the enemy or the opposition. You may see and actually even feel into that the root of all this turmoil is a deep longing to be free from suffering. And somehow you know that you begin to get it, that your freedom from suffering is inextricably linked to their freedom from suffering, you know, the opposition, and theirs is inextricably linked to yours. And in that realization, the grudges, the resentment begin to soften. The anger begins to dissolve. Maybe. Or maybe you sit the whole Zazen period just stewing, ensnared by your resentments. But even then, you are stopping. You're staying present with that stuckness. And you're not doing any further harm. You're not striking out. There's a psychologist named Paul Ekman, who specializes in the study of emotions, and particularly facial expressions, emotions as expressed in facial expressions. And he's a great buddy of the Dalai Lama. They did a whole book of conversations with each other. Ekman identifies what he calls three choice points where awareness can potentially give us the ability to regulate the destructive effects of anger or other strong emotions. So after a triggering event or stimulus, almost instantaneously there's what he calls the appraisal. Is this something we want, that we want to move towards, or something we want to get away from? Is it attractive or threatening or neutral? That's the first choice point, and it's usually not even conscious. We do that all the time. Next is the impulse to respond in some way, to approach or what's attractive, or attack, or escape, what's a threat. So that's the second point, is the impulse. And then the third point is actually taking action, or striking back verbally, right? That's the third choice point. And between the impulse and the action is this space that he calls the refractory period. And during that refractory period, he says, is the functional connection between our primitive brain and our higher functions, our better judgment, our compassion, is short-circuited. We are temporarily disabled. So that's the really key point to be aware of, that impulse, so that we can breathe and stop before the action. So the impulse can arise, but we don't have to act on it. And we don't have to be disabled by that refractory period. And we give a chance for the higher functions, the better judgment, to kick in and guide our response. It's during that refractory period that our reptile brain overrides our human brain. And we are actually not able to take in more information. Have you ever been in an argument with someone and you are trying to tell them how much you care about them and they just aren't hearing it? They are actually short-circuited. They can't take that in. They can't take you in. We've probably all been in that state ourselves as well. We can't take it. We can't reset. In that moment, we can't reset. So that's time out, right? That's the time to stop, take a step back. And when we do take in information, we distort it. We see it through the lens of attack, of defense, of feeling threatened. We quite seriously distort. And it's easy to see when someone else is doing it. Right. No, that's not what I said, right? but it's harder to see when we're doing it. So the key to preventing harmful speech or actions when we're triggered is to shorten that refractory period. Because we can keep that refractory period going. We can keep, we can stay in that disabled state if we stay fired up for quite a long while. So here's where mindfulness practice comes in to assist us in doing that. Or at least to refrain from responding while we're in that state. Right? Might only be seconds, but it can be, as I said, can be longer. Ekman comments that the traditional goal in psychotherapy has been to increase the interval between the impulse and the action. You know, open up some space. So, as I said, so there's time for better judgment that integrates wisdom and compassion to intervene. But in his conversations with the Dalai Lama, he realized that meditation practice trains the mind to extend that awareness even back before the impulse to that appraisal. Is this a threat or a positive thing, something I want or don't want, or neutral? So that the impulse to react arises less forcefully or not at all, or hardly at all. This is how the Dalai Lama has described his experience when he's been asked, well, don't you feel anger in response to the cruelty and injustice of the Chinese towards the Tibetan people? And the Dalai Lama has said something like this: it doesn't arise very often, but when it does, I'm aware of it and it subsides right away. So it's moving the awareness back even earlier, so that the impulse, that over time, with practice, the impulse maybe just goes up and then down. Yeah. Or maybe not at all. Maybe the impulse doesn't even arise because the self-defense mechanism is not even hooked up in that moment. So something that might have been a threat just isn't. So this simple, this might sound hopelessly advanced, right, to us in our typically reactive, not very mindful everyday lives. But the simple practice of moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind is something every one of us can do. Our emotions can only inform us and serve us well if we cultivate the full capacity of our mind for awareness. Then our emotions can serve the purpose. Then our speech and actions can be guided by the qualities of a bodhisattva: patience, kindness, generosity, wisdom. In practicing mindfulness with anger, it can be helpful to be familiar with some of the common habitual patterns, thought patterns, that can trigger an anger reaction. These are conditioned learned patterns. We learn them from our family, we learn them from our society. We get angry when things don't go the way we want. And of course, we don't always get what we want, do we? But somehow we believe we should. So watch out for the word should. That's a really helpful practice, is noticing the word should. We all tend to have often an unacknowledged set of inner rules about how people should behave, right? Well, he should be more considerate, right? Haven't you thought that sort of thing? She shouldn't be so selfish. Should. The trouble with shoulds is people don't necessarily agree with your standards, do they? And they may have a justification for their behavior that to them is perfectly legitimate. How often do you actually get someone to agree that they've said or done something wrong? Once in a while, but usually not. Usually they have a rationalization already ready. How people actually behave is much more governed by how strong their needs are and what inhibiting factors prevent their behavior. So cognitive psychologists have identified some thought fallacies or false beliefs that go with shoulds. The first is entitlement, that belief that because we want something, we are entitled to get it. Whether it's a new job, appreciation from our spouse, respect from our colleagues, cooperation from our children, not grudging cooperation, but ready cooperation from our children. So entitlement, the trouble with entitlement is that it places others under an obligation to us. They feel they should. And that's likely to elicit resentment. Entitlement goes with the assumption that others are there to serve your needs, right? So hand in hand with the entitlement fallacy is the fallacy of fairness, that the world is a just place where the good are rewarded and the bad are punished. So we believe that if we basically don't do bad things and eat the right food and go to the right schools and work hard and be good citizens, nothing bad should happen to us, right? And people should treat us the way we'd like to be treated. Well, you don't need me to tell you that that's not always the case. Even little children quickly catch on to the concept of justice. No fair, right? You hear little children say, that's not fair, when they feel blamed unfairly, or they don't get their fair share of the goodies. Now, some people will use the Eastern concept of karma to explain away all the unfairness in the world, as though all those who experience misfortune or injustice are somehow getting karmic retribution because of past life misdeeds. But not everything reduces down to individual karma, which should be no surprise to us if we understand the Buddha's teaching of no self apart from all other existence, apart from all other beings. We are part of a vast net of interconnectedness. What the Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. Systems far beyond our full understanding or our full control. When we expand our view beyond a self-centered sense of entitlement and fairness, our anger is disarmed. Even if we can't see the full picture, and of course we can't see the whole picture, the causes and conditions of the event that has triggered us is much larger. We can know that there is a larger picture. This is what's called right view, which is one of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught. The view of the Dharma eye that sees impermanence, non-self, or no separate self, and the truth of suffering and the cessation of suffering. That's what the Dharma eye sees. Okay, another thought pattern related to shoulds is that the person you're angry at should change. And that somehow you're telling them what's wrong with them is going to accomplish that. Now tell me, have you ever found that effective? No, what happens is that they feel judged and threatened and they get mad right back at you. And from there it escalates. Obviously they don't care about you. And here's the accompanying thought pattern. Well, if you really loved me, you'd fill in the blank. Do what I want, or be the way I want you to be. And when both parties get caught in this cycle of conditional assumptions, right? If you really cared about me, when both parties get into that cycle, you're really in trouble. You might, in the heat of hurt and anger, feel, but they really hurt me. I can't just let them get away with it. I have to let them know how wrong they are or how much they hurt me. The trouble is, when we are caught up in that anger reaction, our impetus is to strike back. We might deny it. How many times have you heard someone say in a really angry tone of voice, but I'm not mad. I'm not mad, right? But the other person feels, even if you're denying it, the other person feels the heat of the anger, or sometimes just the chill. Right? The trouble with anger is that it's self-focused. Right? Even when it's righteous anger on behalf of a cause or the oppressed or the environment. When that righteous anger is contaminated by ego, by black and white thinking, by hatred of the opposition, it's not going to be effective. It's just going to elicit defensiveness. We'll come back to that question of righteous anger next week. But awareness of some of these mental habit patterns can be helpful there too, I think. It's really important when dealing with our own anger to take responsibility for our own reactions and not blame others. We have a choice in how we respond, at least if we can open up space for awareness. This is the meaning of the Tibetan Lojong statement, drive all blames into one. Some of you probably heard that, drive all blames into one. It means take responsibility for yourself. It doesn't mean wallowing in self-blame and self-punishment. It means seeing clearly and acting with wisdom and compassion. So there are several habit patterns that go with the habit of blaming others. One is black and white thinking, good and bad, right? Someone does something, a friend or a partner or a colleague does something that we label as selfish or uncaring, and suddenly they become the enemy. All the kind and funny and thoughtful things that they've done, suddenly we're blind to, right? Drop out of view. So that kind of thinking, that kind of rigid thinking, also leads to overgeneralizing. You always, you never. Watch out for those. Or exaggerating. I can't believe you did such a stupid thing, right? Or labeling or name calling, it gets worse. If you can just even pick one of those habit patterns to bring, if you know that you have, that you're prone to any one of those, even to choose one to be as a mindfulness practice, to notice that one and stop yourself, you know, like name call, if you're prone to name calling, just choose that to start with. That's an easy one to stop. instead of "you're such a jerk," you know, just see how it feels not to say it. I'm just picking on it, you know, that's really a blatant one. But you can pick any of these. Another more subtle one is, and it's an aspect of blaming, is being quick to assume intent, assuming intent on the part of the other person. We assume deliberate intent to hurt or slight us, right? Or ignore us. The trouble with this kind of mind reading is that it's virtually always wrong or distorted. It's usually just simply not accurate because we really do not know what the other person's experience is. What was influencing them when they said or did what hurt or offended us? And yet this kind of distortion is probably the greatest source of anger. It's our own distorted view. So the reason I'm bringing up these habit patterns for you to consider is that knowing them makes it easier to stop and recognize them. You can just catch yourself more easily if you're familiar with these. You can stop, take a breath, or some time out, go for a walk. You can even say, "I feel kind of upset, I need to collect myself for a few minutes, and then I'll tell you about it." You know, you can let the other person know. And if you do blurt out, "you always" or "you never," you can catch yourself. Before the other person even has a chance to get all upset, you can catch yourself and say, "I know that's not true." You can say that. You have to, you know, be a little bit humble. You can say, "Oh, I know that's not true. You also..." You can say, I just feel really reactive right now. So you have to be prepared to remind yourself over and over again that your view, your self-focused view, is only partial and it's probably distorted. You can remind yourself, as Suzuki Roshi quipped, that it's not always so. Not always so. This thing that you're so convinced of right now. So, how can you turn this reactivity around? How can you transform the energy of anger into deep caring and clear seeing? Well, as I keep saying, by stopping, paying attention to body, mind, and heart. And that's how you open up space during that refractory period between the impulse and the action, the speaking. And in that space, you can feel that vulnerable underbelly, I call it, of anger, in yourself. And that's the place, usually, where you can find a place of deep caring, something you really actually care about. And that's what, then that place is what you can communicate to the other person. You have to be willing to find out more about what lies beneath the other person's behavior as well, rather than making assumptions about why they said or did what they did. We have to be able to practice saying, "when you said that, I had a pretty strong reaction. It would help if I knew more about what was going on for you when you said or did that." Now, you don't have to sound like some script from a communications textbook, you know, those sort of... It all sounds very structured and stiff. You have to be willing to try and be a little clumsy and sometimes even laugh at yourself. And you can't just do that with anyone. If you're in a situation where you're in danger or you're being treated abusively, of course you have to remove yourself from that situation. And then you have to carefully choose how you address the harm that that person has done. But if you're with a partner or a friend or someone that you have some basis for for trust with, then you can take the risk of trying a different way, rather than mutual recrimination or one-sided recrimination and the other side withdrawing and shutting down. It takes practice. If this is not something you learned growing up, and most of us didn't, you're lucky if you did. So that's why the practice of mindfulness, of paying attention to our moment-to-moment experience, is so helpful in dealing with anger. But not only mindfulness, also the Dharma understanding of interconnectedness of self and world, impermanence, and how we suffer from hanging on and pushing away. This Dharma view, this spacious view within which the energy of anger can arise and subside, is the other part of how we practice with anger. So, I've talked a little longer than I wanted to. We could take a very long time working, with this topic. But what I'd like you to take a few minutes to do, I was going to ask you to take time to write, but I don't think we have time, is to think. Just take a moment. I'm going to get you to gather in groups of threes and think of an example of one of these habit patterns, of the shoulds, whether it's overgeneralizing or making an assumption about what the other person's thinking. Just to see what comes up in terms of maybe an actual experience you've had recently, and notice what habit patterns kicked in for you in your reaction, and maybe what the storyline was. If he really cared about me, he'd ask me about my work, right? And because he doesn't, that means he doesn't care. He doesn't care about my work. He doesn't value my work. So how would you? So see if you notice something. One of those habit patterns in you that's come up for you. And then how would you reframe or reword that pattern in you from the view of your Dharma eye? Because that's what we need to do. We're going past cognitive psychology here. Cognitive psychology suggests we reword it and call in kind of coping. They call them coping statements. And that's fine. A coping statement is good. But we're going one step beyond by seeing with the Dharma eye. How would you see it differently? Okay? Do the best you can. So, group up into groups of threes. Turn to face each other. Let's see. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Those two guys. Oh, wait. Okay. Make one group of four. And Minori, you can join over there. Joshua, take you. Okay? So space yourselves out a little better. Go ahead and take your seat over to those guys. And please introduce yourselves, say your names to each other.
Brendan.
Yeah.
Adrian.
Yeah.
Susu. Okay.
Adrian.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Okay. Okay. Don't start yet. Just say your names. And then take a moment just to kind of be quiet and think about what, and don't feel that you have, if my question seems too challenging, just share what your reflections are from the talk, okay? But if you come up with an example, that's good. and how you would reframe that example. Okay? So each of you are just going to have a couple, 2-3 minutes, and I will ring the little bell, and the first person can start, and then if you finish before I ring, this group can keep going. But then just wait until the bell rings, and then the next person goes, okay? And just a reminder that whatever you say just stays right here with respect, and we won't talk about it with each other afterward or outside, okay? So people can feel free to really say what's in their heart, okay? So... first person can start.
So I find that when I get angry, I have like loops in my head.
I live fairly close to Robson Street, which has a lot of pedestrians, it's now summer, and there's tourists, you're walking, so it's slowly and